Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. All right, first, I want to start with a brief little primer in modern biology, for those of you who don't know that much about biology. But most of you out there have probably heard of molecular biology, which took off in the 1970s and led to a lot of things like DNA analysis and forensics and paleontology and many other sciences, and to the cloning of cells and even animals. Remember Dolly the sheep, right? And new methods of pharmaceutical testing, and in medicine, gene therapy and disease diagnosis. So a lot of things have been coming out of molecular biology in the last 40 years or so. Now, when combined with genetics, molecular biology gave us the concept of something a little more obscure called genomics, which involves the study of the structure and function of the entire genome, and that's the complete set of genetic material, within the cells of a living organism. So you might have heard of the sequencing of the human genome, which was a really big deal a few years back and has been nearly completed. I mean, I don't know, it's 99.something% completed of all the human genome. Now, a more recent spinoff, and so I'm just kind of giving a little evolution of some stuff toward the topic of the show here, but a more recent spinoff of this genetic work is called genetic engineering, which is most widely known for producing genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, which are used in medicine and in agriculture. And of course, the latter application in food products has been very controversial over the last several years, for good or bad reasons, right? It's a topic that's talked about widely. Another application is stem cells, which is also a controversial topic. So finally, we come to the topic of this week's show, which is a relatively new subset of genetic engineering called synthetic biology. Now, that's not very well known yet, but I think is likely to become as controversial as GMOs and stem cell engineering. So I wanted to do a show on it to talk about what it is, what it can do, and what the risks and rewards of synthetic biology are. My guest is one of the world's leading pioneers in this field. His name is Dr. George Church. Welcome, Dr. Church.
Hello. It's great to be here.
I talked so long I caught you by surprise, but can we call you George from here on out?
You bet.
So I'll give a little intro of you. He's a professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School and a professor of health sciences and technology at both Harvard and MIT. And Dr. Church's 1984 Harvard PhD included the first methods for direct genome sequencing and something called molecular barcoding, which is kind of like what it sounds, right? So these led to the first genome sequence, which, as it happened, was of a bacterium. George's innovations have contributed to nearly all of the next generation DNA sequencing methods and to several of the companies that do this. He's a member of both the National Academies of Science and of Engineering, and I would say very few people are members of both. So he's the person to talk with about synthetic biology. First, did I describe the evolution of modern biology in 90 seconds or so, more or less correctly?
Yes, that was very succinct and helpful, I think.
Okay, well, that's a surprise to me, too, so that's good. And I gather the basic idea behind synthetic biology is that natural organisms can be reprogrammed to do things they wouldn't normally do, things that might be useful, like make new fuels, for example. So in simple terms, what does it involve, and how does synthetic biology work?
Yes, so synthetic biology is an attempt to apply the principles of other engineering fields, previous engineering fields, to biology, going beyond mere molecular biology to standardized parts for computer-aided design, like you might do for a car, and rigorous testing and safety components.
Okay, so I noticed that you lead the synthetic biology platform at Harvard's WIS Institute. I'm not sure I said that right. But what are you trying to do there? What are the overall goals of your research thrust there at the Institute?
The WIS Institute synthetic biology platform embraces a huge fraction of synthetic biology that is practiced in the world. And in particular, we are interested in developing basic enabling technologies, so the ability to read and write genomes, whole collections of genes from many organisms, for applications in medicine, agriculture, and environmental needs.
So are you trying to find, to work out the sequence of whole genomes of organisms to make new tools for medicine, for example?
So for example, we can use some of our synthetic biology tools for making organs in pigs, and humanizing pigs so the organs will not be rejected when transplanted into humans. It's a huge need. Millions of people are in need worldwide. Making engineering environmental components so that You can fight mosquito and other vector-borne diseases like malaria, which again affect millions of people, so that you can make virus-resistant organisms for agriculture and industrial microbial synthesis, and so on. There's many applications of synthetic biology, and we're both trying to develop the technology to read and write these systems, just like you might read and write to a disk drive. But then once you have those generic tools and applying them to very specific problems.
Okay, well, let's talk some more about some of these potential applications of synthetic biology. One that's really prominent, and you mentioned it, is biofuels. What kind of fuels would be produced? Would it be something you could put in your regular car?
The interest in alternative fuels waxes and wanes with the competitive sources such as coal, natural gas, and petroleum, and even alternatives with wind power and solar and so on. I think that field has morphed slightly into making specialty chemicals. In other words, the energy component is less critical now than the ability to sequester carbon into useful compounds. So you might have the output from a coal-burning plant, which normally would be waste, pumped into cyanobacteria, blue-green algae that can then turn it into useful products like detergents, plastics, and so on. But also fuels are made. So, for example, companies like Joule Unlimited and LS9 were pioneers in figuring out how to get Koch's bacteria into making long-chain alkanes, meaning chemicals that like diesel fuel and gasoline that you use in vehicles.
So potentially you could actually have bacteria producing diesel fuel.
That's correct.
Another one that's interesting is generating electricity. How would that be done?
Well, there are some bacteria that can naturally turn waste products, you know, that might come from, say, sewage treatment plants or other agricultural runoff and so forth, and turn it into weak electrical current. And it's not really on a par with solar, but they could be used for running sensors and so forth. I think more powerful is various ways of coupling solar energy to manufacturing a variety of chemicals. It's hard to make those chemicals purely with physics and chemistry, but when you combine in the biochemistry of living systems, then you can really make a whole diversity of products, flavors, fragrances, lubricants, all kinds of things. Some of them are pretty high demand or high quality chemicals.
Be an interesting sales challenge to sell perfume to, let's say, a female market where the perfumes had been manufactured by bacteria.
Right. Well, you don't always know where everything in your products come from.
The source, yeah. But at least no animals were injured in the production of these products, right? So, yeah, you mentioned basically synthetic replacement organs or using pigs to grow organs that would not be rejected by humans. But is there a possibility of making actually synthetic livers and kidneys and so on, things that people stand in line to get parts for now?
Yes. There are a number of approaches to solving the transplantation crisis. These range from 3D printing of cells to getting organs to develop in the lab, from embryonic-like stem cells to having them made in pigs, which produce the right size and shaped organs for direct transplantation, and solve some of the problems that happen with 3D printing and developing in the lab.
Another medical application of synthetic biology would be custom-tailored medical treatment. So kind of give a couple of examples of what that would be, you know, something that's very targeted to the individual, and how would they do that?
Right. So there are drugs that definitely can be, at the wrong dose, can be toxic to a person. There are drugs that are customized to your cancer. So almost every cancer has random mutations that accompany it that are potential targets for the immune system. This is probably the most rapidly growing field of therapies, which is developing T cells, a kind of immune cell normally in your blood, making custom T cells that attack your particular cancer. Or you could make a antibody that attacks your particular cancer.
One that is likely to draw the most public interest because of the colorfulness and drama of it is the recreation of extinct animals. You know, taking mammals that, some DNA has been found and then basically rebuilding it. So talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Sure. I mean, this is part of a bigger effort for applying modern molecular methods to longstanding environmental and ecological conservation efforts, so modernizing those conservation efforts, and it in no way interferes with them. In fact, it probably brings attention and money to help augment these problems. And the idea is that you can introduce diversity that might be missing. You can increase diversity. Normally, when we think of ecological and environmental problems, we think of the diversity decreasing and ending up with wastelands, which are not in the best interests of the human or the remaining species. And so with these new molecular methods, like genome editing and genome sequencing, reading and writing genomes, you can go through, find the diversity that exists, if necessary, bring in diversity from other parts of the world, or even go back in time. So you can bring in, you can go to museums or ancient specimens, you can go into the tundra and sequence the DNA, put it in the computer, and then rewrite it from the computer into DNA that can then be put into living animals and increase their diversity. A most dramatic example of this, the mammoth, which is fairly recently in the big picture over the last 4,000 years, 10,000 years, has been become extinct. And the Asian elephant is getting close to becoming extinct. If you could now allow the Asian elephant to repopulate the huge and quite rich ecosystem that the mammoth recently left because of human hunters, now you can control those human hunters a little bit better. And you could extend the Asian elephant range to all of the Siberian, Canadian, and Alaskan tundra, then you could both save that species, but also improve the quality of the entire ecosystem by allowing it to alter the temperature of the soil by as much as 20 degrees. And there are experiments been done that to back this up. And that will help lock in the carbon, huge amount of carbon that we would not want to release into the atmosphere. Whether or not you're a global warming aficionado, twice as much carbon as all the forests of the world is a lot of carbon to release in the atmosphere. So anything that could move the needle in the correct direction would be welcome.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. George Church, who is a genetic engineer and a scientist at Harvard Medical School, and who is one of the leading proponents in the world of something called synthetic biology. And that's what we're talking about, the potential, you know, benefits and rewards, and as well as the risks we're going to get to a little bit later of talking about synthetic biology. So we've just been, George was just describing the concept of basically bringing a mammoth, the woolly mammoth, back from extinction using synthetic biology, which is becoming, you know, a more real possibility to do. But so you mentioned the Asian elephant. How would you do it? Just kind of in a nutshell, George, would you start with an actual living elephant and inject some DNA from that had been amplified from some material that had been found frozen in a riverbank in Siberia or something? I mean, how would you physically do the thing?
Well, this project is benefiting from other projects that are closer to the mainstream of biomedical research that benefits humans. And so it's very low cost and depends on breakthroughs in adjacent fields. But the idea is that you would take any elephant cell, and there are many of them that we have from skin and endothelial cells from their blood vessels and from placenta. Anyway, you take those cells, do genome editing in the lab on the cells using DNA that you synthesize based on the computer, and can include computer files on ancient elephant species like the mammoth. That's now put in the right place to do the right thing. For example, provide cold resistance genes to the elephant cells. Now, nudging it in the direction, and you don't have to change every single base pair of the genome, just the ones that confer cold resistance. And then you can get embryos to develop in the lab. And no one has yet gotten a mammalian embryo to grow all the way to a free living state in the lab, but that's becoming increasingly feasible, and it will be based on ongoing experiments in mice and then transferred over to the elephant experiment. So in parallel will be the engineering of the genome of the Asian elephant to look more and more like a mammoth, and that will converge with experiments to get embryo development, to go to fetal development, and finally to a free living elephant. It's uncertain how long these things take, but my experience has been recently that most new technologies arrive way ahead of schedule, not behind schedule, sometimes in decades faster than most people predicted.
So if I understand it correctly, this wouldn't be a full-blown woolly mammoth as if it stepped out of the Pleistocene or whatever era they lived, but that it would be kind of a hybrid between an existing Asian elephant and a woolly mammoth. Is that more or less right?
It probably could be whatever we want. I mean, it's just a matter of time and effort to change more and more genes. But probably just changing a small number of genes, maybe 50 genes or so, it would look and behave and be cold resistant just like a mammoth. And then you can continue to change genes, but you won't see much change other than you'll know in your heart that it's closer and closer to a mammoth. But basically, already, if you have something that is happy at minus 40 degrees, has long woolly hair and small ears and so on, then I think the rest of it is kind of icing on the cake.
All right. Well, I guess we get here toward the big $64 billion question or whatever. Would it be possible to create a synthetic human genome?
Right. So the first question to ask with all these projects is why? What's the problem we're trying to address? Because that will determine whether the risks and benefits relative to current practice. So with human cells, one of the problems that you might want to fix is the safety and security of human cell lines that are either used for manufacturing pharmaceuticals, vaccines, or orphan drugs, or the same sort of issues come up with stem cell therapies, where you want your cells to be resistant to viruses, maybe reduced in their senescence and cancer causing capabilities. If these are to be used either producing therapies or as therapies in their own right, we'd like to make virus resistant cells. So that's posing the problem, and the potential solution is changing the genetic code of all the genes in the genome. So the genome is a collection of all genes, and you would change all of them, say, have a new genetic code. The code is what tells the cell how to go from DNA to proteins, proteins being the catalysts and the structural components of your whole body, like hair, you know, blood cells, and so on. So that process, that genetic code, can be altered, and we've already done this in microorganisms that are of industrial significance to make those microorganisms resistant to all viruses. And we know that there are, just as manufacturing in microbes has problems with virus infections, same thing happens with mammalian human cells in culture. If you're trying to manufacture at a very large scale and you get a little virus and contamination, it can wipe you out for 2 years. And this happened, for example, in the company Genzyme in my state in Massachusetts. So by changing the genetic code, you can make it so different that the viruses assume a certain code. They expect a certain code. And when it comes in and there's a different code, then they can't replicate. So that's a general way it works for all viruses simultaneously, even viruses you've never seen before. So it's a really remarkable opportunity.
I know that one of the goals of synthetic biology is to make it more, as you said, like manufacturing, even using standardized biological circuits and off-the-shelf parts and inventories, or they're called registries. So how is that done? I mean, are there actual parts kept somewhere on a, you know, on a shelf or in a laboratory, or is it just instructional, how-to instructions, basically, to manufacture your own parts? What is the standardization of parts aspect of it?
Yeah, so there are parts that people have characterized very well, and some of them are available through organizations like adgene.org. Adgene.org is a nonprofit that redistributes people's parts. Parts have been engineered by researchers,
yeah.
And these might be parts that make fluorescence or luminescence or tools for reading and writing genomes. All these things are like nanomachines. They're encoded in pieces of DNA, and they can be used by anybody in the world that, you know, has a legitimate research plan and can access the adgene.org. That's one way of standardization, but you can also synthesize them from scratch. They're present in the literature, they're present in computer databases, and you can just ask a company to synthesize it for you. Sometimes that's more convenient if you want to make changes rather than getting it from AdGene and using that as a start point. But they're both ways of distributing the know-how in physically instantiated parts.
So you mentioned people with the proper access authority being able to get to these parts, but in reality, who can have access to these catalogs of parts? Is it at this point, who is it?
In principle, there are procedures in place, some of which I asked for in a white paper I wrote in 2004, where you do surveillance on who's ordering and what they're ordering. So you don't want, you know, some high school freshman ordering smallpox. So, for example, so there are computer methods for screening to make sure that people have the right institution to safely do the experiments and that they're asking for components that are themselves intrinsically safe. And if not, then they need to get very special permission from the government. And typically it's done in a high containment facility, a physical and biological containment, sometimes called a biological safety level 4 would be the highest level of containment. And that's not something that people would take lightly.
Okay, so this is the thing that a lot of people are going to find potentially worrisome because, as we know, people can hack into databases where they're not theoretically, in principle, permitted. And then once in, they can distribute those things. So it might not be the high school kid. It might be a terrorist, right? So one can envision people with evil intent cooking up powerful new disease organisms or even manufacturing humans in the future with specific dangerous traits. I mean, these things verge into science fiction, and all good intentions notwithstanding, it's possible for things to get out of human control or out of the control of the people who are theoretically the controllers, right? So that's where I think the rubber meets the road as far as the possible risks that we mentioned of the future of synthetic biology. And there are now technologies that automate and speed up this genetic manipulation. And so it's possible to envision, in other words, like a Jurassic Park or a Frankenstein that you can make in your basement. You can manipulate evolution. I know that you mentioned it a little bit, but you've been at the bleeding edge of efforts to develop policies for biosafety and biosecurity. But I think this is where the public controversy in the future, as this becomes better known, will focus. So let's talk about that. I mean, what are the plans? And you mentioned a couple of them, but are there safeguards for the really bad actor who's trying to penetrate the safeguards?
Right. Well, so I worry about these things, and I encourage people to worry about them, and far in advance, you know, before the technology gets to that point, there are safeguards that take advantage of how limited are the number of companies that can make synthetic DNA at high quality and low cost. If you see someone who's going around those regulations by, say, building their own machines, synthesizing their own raw chemicals, purifying their own raw chemicals, all of this is a lot of extra work when it's much cheaper and faster to just order it. If you order it, then you're under surveillance because of the tracking of the orders. If you make it yourself, you're under surveillance because you're clearly doing something strange because you're spending extra time and money. So either way, it increases the probability we'll detect people that are either explicitly making smallpox or explicitly trying to get around the surveillance. Nothing is perfect. I mean, clearly there, it's hard to even keep track of extremely well-regulated nuclear armaments. Mm-hmm. This is considerably cheaper and considerably more widely spread. But the efforts are to, it's a numbers game to reduce this down to make it inconvenient. Not to mention the fact that the most powerful bioweapons, the combination of convenience and power, is likely to be in natural pathogens. They've evolved for millions of years, and they're much more likely to survive and thrive than something that you made up in your lab. Most things you make in your lab will not survive in the wild. So, I mean, this is not to downplay the significance of engineered pathogens, but the fact is natural pathogens can be more threatening. It's just a matter of delivery, really, is the issue. And that's an issue for whether they're synthetic or natural.
So I think it's inevitable that it's going to be something that governments will want to regulate and keep track of, and even that's a, you know, something that's done with five thumbs often. So it's a, to me, it introduces a new dimension of something to worry about that that bad things can come from, and you can do all you can do to try to set up barriers and safeguards and control the access to it. But it's going to be tricky, I think, and I'm sure you know about it. I think there are professional ethics people who are involved in these discussions, and I imagine they worry about it, and it's good they're there because they can, you know, science tends to do what it can do, and technology tends to do to go forward with the sexiness of what it's able to do, even sometimes when it's aware of the risks, right? And but to downplay the risks some, and so it's tricky to find that balance between progress and risk, right? And it always is, but in this particular case, maybe more so. So, you know, I'm sure you're well aware of it, and probably all the people involved are. Let's switch topics. We just have a minute or so left here, but you were one of the founders of the Human Genome Project back in 1990, and in 2005, you started your own personal genome project, which is kind of a big thing. Why don't you tell us about that just briefly, George, if you can, and whether someone can join your project.
Right. The Personal Genome Project is the only project in the world that makes it possible to share data, to get access to your own data, whether it's through healthcare or other research projects, and add value to it and then share it worldwide. And it's been used by the National Institute of Standard Technology and the Food and Drug Administration and many other organizations worldwide in order to standardize and to develop better diagnostic tests and new therapies. So if you want to be part of that, then you can go to personalgenomes.org and see if it's a good match for you and volunteer.
Are the results private if you do volunteer and participate?
The results are public. That's the intention, is to make this very easy for researchers to access and for you to access your own data. Many projects don't engage the public enough, so they don't return the information to the individuals.
So in this case, they do return it to you, but it's public too. Is it public by name or just sort of a coded number? Or how does that work?
It's up to you. We emphasize that almost everything that is promised to be secret could not be. You know, so many of your medical records are actually more valuable on the black market than your credit card information. Is about 20 times as valuable.
Wow.
And so people who make promises of privacy, you should be very skeptical of those. So we make a promise of public sharing rather than disingenuous promises of privacy.
Okay, fair enough. Well, Dr. George Church, this has been fascinating, talking about the emerging science of synthetic biology and its potential and all the good things and the potentially bad things that might come from it. And it's going to be a big field and a big discussion in the public sphere in the future, I think. To see some short videos of Dr. George Church talking about his research, go to the website BigThink, just like it sounds, bigthink.com/experts/George Church. Dr. Church, thank you so much for being on with us and talking about synthetic biology. It's been fascinating.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.